Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 11th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. Delighted to have with me in the studio, Mike Robinson.
Yeah.
And we're also joined by Mark Anderson from the USA.
We're going to start today with Grant Shapps. He's been in Kiev, of course. Where else would he be? Let's have a look.
I'm the British Defence Secretary here in Kyiv to raise the alarm, because what would it say if we allow a democratic country to be taken over by a dictator like Putin? What would it say about our values of freedom and democracy? And it doesn't have to be this way, because we easily have the resources of the West if we have the will. So the message is simple. This is a wake-up call for the world. Let's make sure Ukraine wins this war.
So the question is, did you notice it? In case you didn't, let's just bring him back on screen with a still. We've got to just put a couple of rings around the swastikas, which are on the tank that he walked past. And I have to ask, Brian, was he aware? Did he know? Was he blind? Did he just not see it?
He doesn't care.
Does he not care? No. As expected, the Russians, of course, jumped on this, and the Russian embassy pushing this out on Saturday. Thank you, Grant Shapps, for clearly showing the abundance of Nazi swastikas in central Kyiv. This is exactly what Russia is fighting against. And of course, anybody that's criticizing him for this undoubtedly is a Russian propagandist.
Well, this is true. I am going to say that one of those appears to be over the rust. So the machine was rusty when it was painted, but there's plenty more pictures of swastikas on Ukrainian military vehicles, so we don't have to worry about the actual background. Let's move on to the war itself, and I'm just going to use this from Weeb Union. As people know, I try and share the material from the really excellent analysts who are reporting on social media. So I took this still because of its importance in showing the nature of the battlefield. And the yellow dots are defensive positions. So you see that the Russians have got essentially a heavy line right the way along the front line. And we can now see that in Ukrainian territory, the Ukrainian defences are strong points, which in some places are quite well spread out, in others are quite dense. And of course, for the Russians to regain the rest of the territory for their special military operation, that's the area in blue that you can see, or edged in blue. And the Russians are now essentially rooting out the Ukrainians from these smaller strong points in the countryside. And the only way we can sort of show some of this is to have a look at some of the drone footage. And of course, you see the amazing flatlands of the Ukrainian, what's essentially the Ukrainian steppe. But within each of the hedgerows, the Ukrainians have got small groups of men and some heavy artillery, military vehicles, some tanks. And the Russians are simply working very steadily, very slowly, in order to root out the Ukrainians from these defensive positions. And of course, the thing is that the Russians have got unlimited munitions and very heavy munitions to be able to use on the Ukrainian positions, whereas now it's very clear the Ukrainians are starting to run out of ammunition, particularly artillery shells. And of course, their defensive positions are suffering as a result. So the first lie that we've been told in the West is that Russia was going to run out of munitions, when the reality is that Ukraine has run out, and so has the Western power base, including the United States, because we simply cannot provide Ukraine with the amount of shells that they need on a daily basis to counter the Russians. The other thing to see here, of course, is that the battlefield surveillance is total by drones, but also those drone variants can hunt other vehicles. And here we see a Ukrainian gun in a defensive position, which is eventually destroyed as a result of a drone attack. The drones are very significant in this war because, particularly in this open terrain, it makes it difficult for either side to hide larger military vehicles such as tanks or field guns. However, the Russians are operating more drones and therefore they're increasing losses on the Ukrainian side. But I will say that it's now obvious that Russia is actually fighting the West, because the West is providing total battlefield surveillance from drones flying over the Black Sea. And also we have Western operators clearly on the ground helping to target Western weapon systems, such as the Storm Shadow missile. And therefore, the reality is that NATO is at war against Russia. And to be honest, I'm just surprised at the amount of patience on the Russian side that they're not responding to this attack on the battlefield. But on the subject of the West Wonder weapons, I'm told today that Abrams, the American Abrams tank number 4, has been destroyed. So 31 of them supplied to the Ukrainians, 4 are now gone. And of course, what's also gone is the myth that this tank can survive on the battlefield, whereas the claim from the Americans has always been that the Russian tanks in particular inferior and of a poor quality. But if we go on through, if that's the remains of the Abrams American tank, this is embarrassment for UK, because one of the Challengers got itself stuck in the famous Ukrainian mud. And I believe that was while it was giving a demonstration to Sun reporters. But of course, the same thing applies, that the Challenger, a very good tank itself, but to try and say that a few Challengers are going to change the course of the war in Ukraine is a complete and utter nonsense. So what's the reality? Well, I'm just going to bring people to this very tragic article that was sent through to me, Eastern Daily Press. It's from a little while ago, but it's talking about a young man from Norfolk who volunteered to fight in Ukraine. And he's now taken his own life after suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what came out at the inquest. I'll put a little bit of text on screen. But it said that Harry Gregg had no formal military training other than a spell in the army cadets, but decided to fly out to help defend the country following its invasion by Russia. He ended up fighting in the trenches, where he witnessed the death of his comrades and reported seeing the aftermath of Russian atrocities. Of course, that's...
I was just going to say, you know, we see more and more rhetoric coming out of the UK government at the moment about the danger of misinformation, the danger of disinformation that leads to deaths. And yet here we have government information, which is absolutely leading to British deaths in Ukraine, because people have fallen into the trap of believing the story.
This is absolutely true. So if we pop that one up on screen, what's actually mentioned in this tragic case is that this young man went and did what he did because he was apparently fired up by Liz Truss, saying that people should volunteer and go and fight the Russians. So a tragic case, but if we look at some of the things that came out in the inquest, it was his third visit to the country that he actually found himself fighting. He was called Eagle and he was assigned to the Ukrainian 48th Battalion. One of his relatives said he told me about things he'd seen which he knew would stick in his head. That's the seat of the trauma. They were being shelled quite badly. Well, that's probably an understatement, because the Russians' shelling has been really incredible. And the West has been very surprised at the intensity of the shelling that the Russians can call down on positions. But then he talks here about a comrade who was speaking to him, telling him to keep his head down. And 10 minutes later, the man giving the warning was shot in the head. And it said Harry had to put his friend in a body bag. So this is immensely tragic stuff. But on the other hand, we've still got thousands of mercenaries who have gone from the West, Europe in particular, into Ukraine. And those Ukrainians are now being slaughtered alongside the other Ukrainian troops. Yes, of course, there are Russian casualties. But the reality is at the moment that although Zelensky has claimed that he's demobilized some 30,000 Ukrainians. The truth is that the Ukrainian losses are truly horrendous. And the figure that I've quoted a number of times, this is the figure that's being mentioned by a number of very reliable analysts, is about 400,000 Ukrainian deaths. But as we'll see later in the news, the Ukrainian solution is to call up more men and now to mobilize women as well. So truly horrific situation. And of course, if the West and the US would stop pumping in weapons, this war would be over in a matter of days and some form of productive peace agreement could be achieved. So it's just horrific, Mike, what is going on. And to see that idiot of a British politician crowing just because he can stand in front of a few burnt out vehicles, I think is truly pathetic. Mark, let's bring you in because you've been having a look at veterans in the States, and it seems that the US system is also concerned about the power of veterans.
Yes, ironic, guys, that first report should be brought up. In that report, you're talking about people that are fighting currently, they're believing the government line, and they're dying as a result. Now you're looking at U.S. veterans being surveyed by the Military Times, and the Military Times, whose background we'll look into in just a minute, is worried that veterans are catching on to what's going on, former fighters. And so the Military Times survey is worded like this: alarming percentage of veterans, that means, accepting conspiracies. And you see a picture there, you are fake news. We'll move on from there, and I'll outline this about us. This is militarytimes.com. It's part of Sightline Media Group, known as the Army Times Publishing Company, which first published Army Times in 1940. We'll get into a chronology in just a minute. They claim to have the highest standards of journalism, and they claim to have veterans' best interests at heart, and et cetera, et cetera. We'll go on from there. These slides will be in the show, of course. Most readers, that is veterans who primarily read these publications, could spot disinformation, they're glad to say. But look at who they're championing here. The World Economic Forum declared disinformation as the most severe risk over the next 2 years. So the WEF is apparently okay in the eyes of the Military Times and other associated publications. And the WEF wrote in its annual report in January that the spread of false information could undermine the legitimacy of newly elected governments across the globe and result in violent protests, hate crimes, and terrorism. So they're automatically assuming that any newly elected government is legitimate and honorable, and if you protest, you're the bad guy. Researchers, get this, are already seeing instances of Russian interference in the U.S. this year, including a coordinated effort around the Texas-Mexico border, of all places, and that crisis, and Russia is supposedly trying to amplify calls for a civil war. According to Kyle Walter, head of research at Logically, which is a British tech company, and that tech company uses AI to monitor disinformation around the world. They're so vigilant looking out for us. Walter said Russia is likely to increase its spread of falsehoods in the run-up to the November election. Here we go again on that. The U.S. needs no help in conducting questionable and in many cases, dishonest elections. They do not need Russia's help at all. But we'll move on from there. And this is just an item. I won't really read it. But in that Military Times survey article, they put this post there, this X post, a.k.a. Twitter. And they asked the question, does this post present credible fact-based information that is well sourced and easy to share? And all it is an offhand comment. They act as if somebody just writing a quick off-the-cuff opinion is supposed to have a whole list of unchallengeable sources at their disposal. And this vet named Tom is just giving his opinion about the military being in a deplorable shape. But anyway, back to the Sightline Media Group, we'll move on and describe who's behind the Military Times. It's not the military. They publish Military Times as well as Army Times, Air Force Times, and Marine Corps Times. founded in 1940, as I mentioned, as Army Times Publishing Company. Parent company is Archetype, aka Regent LP, purchased 1997 by mass media giant Gannett. Gannett published USA Today for many, many years. I believe they still do. Gannett spun off these properties to a company called Tegna in 2015. Tegna then sold Sightline Media Group to Regent, a LA-based private equity firm, and Regent is controlled by an investor named Michael Reinstein. So the military is not at all involved in publishing this publication, and I think many people, including veterans, are under the impression that the military at least has a hand in putting out those publications. And one of the things that the veterans who won't swallow the party line, one of the things they're accused of, besides election denial and besides various other beliefs in so-called conspiracies, they're also accused of believing in so-called replacement theory. And you'll note that the border was mentioned regarding Russia supposedly trying to stir up trouble regarding the U.S. southern border. But one can believe what one wants to believe, but replacement theory, more than any one source, comes from Richard Coudenhove Kalergi, the Austrian-Japanese diplomat, a shining example of a coercive utopian under the guise of being a austere statesman. And this is from Chatham House, the EU's forgotten grandfather, Richard Coudenhove Kalergi. I won't get into reading it much, but he had more than anyone, he had responsibility for establishing the groundwork for the European Union, although some people also attribute that to Bilderberg founder Joseph Redinger. Redinger and Kalergi, I've never been able to determine, it's early here, guys. I've never been able to confirm whether those two ever crossed paths and actually met. But both of them have some share in creating the groundwork, among other factors, for the European Union. Anyway, according to Wikipedia, not an unimpeachable source, I realize, but the Kalergi plan is described here, is sometimes called the Coudenhove-Kalergi conspiracy, and Wikipedia is just cocksure that they're right about this. They're calling it a debunked far-right anti-Semitic white genocide conspiracy theory. The theory claims that Austrian-Japanese politician, he was really a diplomat, Richard von Coudenhove-Kalergi, creator of the Pan-European Union, concocted this plot to mix white Europeans with other races via immigration. Well, readers and viewers can make up their own mind on this. I'm just trying to have a reasoned, balanced discussion of this, but there's one more slide here. This is what Kalergi actually said, and people can make up their own mind. The man of the future will be of mixed race. Today's races and classes will gradually disappear owing to the vanishing of space, time, and prejudice. The Eurasian Negroid race of the future, similar in its appearance to the ancient Egyptians, will replace the diversity of peoples with a diversity of individuals. So the mass media cartel will not have an open, frank, candid discussion about this, but that's what I'm trying to provide today. And again, readers and viewers can make up their own mind if that actually constitutes the great replacement theory. But many people I've talked to over the years whose opinions I respect believe it does constitute a calling for a replacement. So, you know, it's a matter of opinion, perhaps, but there it is.
Mark, thank you very much for that. I'll just add to that, of course, that when you see people planning how people will relate to each other, which nationalities are going to be living where, that is very historical that you've just given us. But of course, let's remind people that Sir Peter Sutherland, the US ambassador for migration, was on record of saying that more mass migration was needed to break down the homogeneity of the nation states. So it's not just one person that is talking about doing this. And of course, what UK Column has said on many, many occasions is when this forced migration happens, people suffer wherever they've come from originally.
Absolutely. Now, today is Monday the 11th of March, as everybody will know. And right now, at this minute, Gordon Brown is speaking at the Institute for Government. And I'm sure it's a real shame that we're not all able to watch that. But this is basically what he's intending to say, or what he is saying. The way we govern will have to be radically transformed. and government put on a war footing if Britain is to break free from the vicious low growth, low productivity and low wage cycle. So we are to be put on a war footing almost immediately if we are going to survive the coming economic situation.
Sorry to twitch there, Mike. So it's not put on a war footing in order to fight the Russians, which we're being told from one side of the camp. This is to get us free of vicious low growth. It's all in our best interest.
Yeah, but we've got to fight the Russians in order to do that, is basically what he's saying. We've got to start a war with Russia and China in order to get ourselves out of this economic mess. So just so long as everybody's clear about that. Now, I showed this little bit of video on Monday of Ursula von der Leyen as she was speaking in preparation, because she'd be put forward by her party to stand again for a second term as President of the European Commission. Just listen to this once again in case you didn't see it on Friday.
Security in Europe also means doing more on our own defence. Our common goal should be very clear. We need to turbocharge our defence industrial capacity in the next 5 years. And at the heart of this must be one simple principle. Europe must spend more, Europe must spend better, and Europe must spend European. And this will help us fill the urgent need to rebuild, replenish, and modernize member states' armed forces, and to keep supporting Ukraine. And in doing so, Europe should strive to develop and manufacture the next generation of battle-winning operational capabilities. And my friends, the EPP is the party that has championed a Europe.
Okay, so that's enough of that. Now, on Friday, I was suggesting that was quite Hitler-esque in her delivery, and I think it was. Anyway, here's the point. We go back a couple of years, and Ursula von der Leyen had this to say. We need to take further bold steps in the next 5 years towards a genuine European defence union. Europe's 100 billion euro a year defence industry is one of our most valuable and strategic assets. Now, that was in 2019. And here we are 5 years later. And this is right back on the table again for her next session as President of the European Commission. Well, following on from that, then, this gentleman, Christian Lindner, was writing in Frankfurter Allgemeine a couple of days ago, and he was saying this: the strategic nuclear forces of France and Great Britain are already making a contribution to the security of our alliance. The French President Emmanuel Macron has made various offers of cooperation. He said we should understand that Donald Trump's recent statements as a call to further rethink this element of European security under the umbrella of NATO. And finally here, he said, the question is, under what political and financial conditions would Paris and London be prepared to maintain and expand their own strategic capabilities for collective security? So again, here we are a few years following Brexit, and we're right back into the European Defence Union narrative again. This is being pushed extremely hard. Let's just remind us, because many people won't have been viewers of the UK column when we covered this in the past. So let's just remind ourselves what the European Defence Union is supposed to look like. This is their, this is my rendition of their graphic. And at the bottom there, you will see that the foundation of this is the political will to invest in European security and progressively frame a common defence policy. And so this is the narrative that von der Leyen was talking about last week and has been talking about for the last number of years, in fact. But at the right-hand pillar there in this eight pillars, the right-hand pillar there is core partnerships, NATO and the United Nations. So this tweet then, again, going back to 2019 from Guy Verhofstadt, saying, for 70 years, NATO has been a cornerstone of our security. Now it's vital we strengthen NATO by building its European pillar based on a European defence community, a European army, so that Europeans can take the future into their own hands. This is something they see themselves as being in NATO at a European level, rather than being in NATO at a French, German, Dutch level, and so on. Bringing that graphic back on screen again, on the left-hand side, we've got another pillar, which is bi and multilateral cooperation amongst member states. And I just want to remind everybody what the situation is, particularly with respect to the UK. Because when we look at the number of bilateral and multilateral arrangements that there are, I mean, this is just a fraction of it, just to give you an idea. We've got, the Aachen Treaty between the UK, France and Germany. We've got the Lancaster House Treaties between the UK and France. We've got treaties with the UK and the Netherlands, with the UK and Czech Republic, with Poland, with Spain. We've got all these bilateral and multilateral agreements going on, which have got nothing whatever to do with the European Union. And then again, going back a few years, here is Lord Freddie Howe, Defence Minister, in 2019. And he said that at that time, I signed the UK into the European Intervention Initiative. The agreement states EI2 intends to contribute to ongoing efforts within the European Union to deepen defence cooperation, notably PESCO. So although this has nothing to do with European Union, or it is linked to PESCO, which of course is a European Union defence union policy. So looking to the House of Commons library to see what EI2 is all about, this is what they say. The European Intervention Initiative is a French-led initiative set out by President Macron in September 2017 as part of his vision for a, quote, sovereign, united and democratic Europe, unquote. In order to achieve that ambition, he put forward proposals for a common European intervention force and a common doctrine for action independent of the European Union. It goes on to say 10 European countries, including the UK, are involved in the initiative. Italy indicated its willingness to join in September 2019. Given that EI1 is a defensive initiative outside of the governance of the European Union, UK participation in it will not be affected in any way by Brexit. So we are tied into these defence agreements, which are going to be form part of EU defence union, even though we're not supposedly part of Brexit, or Brexit has got no relevance to it. Now, if you want to know more about this, again, we haven't really updated this page since 2019 after Brexit was allegedly done and dusted. But nonetheless, this is starting to come back into the media again, or at least the political agenda again. So I'm sure we will be adding more to this page, but there's plenty of resource there to show a timeline of how we've got to this point, a number of articles and the timeline, a fantastic resource. But kind of related to this, or at least I reminded myself of this as I was pulling this segment together earlier on today, I just wanted to bring RAND Europe back on screen. And this, again, is going back to 2018 or 2019 or so. The utility of military force and public understanding in today's Britain. And I just wanted to look at this and consider where we are today and see how accurate they were in their predictions, in inverted commas. And so they decided that hybrid war targets the role of popular opinion in shaping national strategy. And we are absolutely well into a hybrid war at this point. They also said that social resilience is receiving increasing attention in relation to national security. And they also said that the effect of ignoring domestic resilience is to undermine deterrence. And they had some recommendations. I'm just going to highlight four of them, that they wanted to emphasize the shared responsibility of resilience, that they wanted to recommend creating coherence in communications, i.e. get hold of the narrative and get hold of it tight. Connecting the armed forces and the government. We've been talking about this for the last couple of years. Increasingly, fusion doctrine is right there at the heart of the Ministry of Defence's defence doctrine. And finally, being open to debate on national service. And lo and behold, here we are. And only a few weeks ago, we had the Telegraph and others talking about public face call-up if we go to war, military chief warns, and a whole discussion about conscription and military service. But not only that, the resilience narrative is something which is just being shoved down our throats constantly. So this is from The National, UK's Cameron to call for strength, resilience and unity in Berlin visit. So this is from a couple of days ago, 2nd of March, I think, and so on. So, you know, this issue of single defence in Europe and Britain's participation in it has not gone away. It's absolutely there, and Brexit has got nothing to do with it.
Yes, it's just incredible. But I look at Cameron, if he's there talking to the Germans, who are also calling for essentially mobilisation, who is Cameron working for? Is he now working with and for the Germans? Is he working for Israel? We've got no idea what's going on. And I'll just draw people's attention to Christopher Story's book, The EU Collective Enemy of Its Member States, a really detailed analysis. One of the points that Christopher Story pointed out is the rise of the bilateral and other agreements, and he described them as a spider's web, which eventually meant that a country like Britain couldn't move of its own accord because it was locked into these bilateral agreements. You can find that online if you search for that book.
And just to end this segment then, this furore has begun. So obviously Queen Elizabeth, HMS Queen Elizabeth, one of our two aircraft carriers, can't go to sea at the moment because it's broken, and it's, so it's way back to the Clyde to be fixed, just as its sister ship was. But UK Defence Journal was reporting a day or two ago that it had suffered a fire, but don't worry, there were no fatalities. And this resulted in a whole furore within the mainstream media, with the mainstream media saying this is yet another example of the British military in a state of collapse. As a result, various comments on Twitter, mainstream media have lost their minds, said Navy Lookout, about UK Defence Journal report of fire on board HMS Queen Elizabeth yesterday. Minor shipboard fires are not uncommon. All sailors are trained in firefighting, and in this instance appear to have responded quickly and extinguished the fire with no injuries. Involvement of local civilian fire brigade is also standard procedure. And Brian, I'm just going to say, I don't know what the scale of course, nobody is saying what the nature of this fire was or what the scale of the fire was. But, you know, if it was really so insignificant, then why report it in the first place? What did UK Defence Journal expect was going to happen when they published this article?
This is the key point. Fires do happen on board warships. They've always happened on warships because they're very dangerous environments with fuel, inflammable substances, a lot of people. But minor fires are one thing. Fires that are more serious are something else. But also, we got no detail as to what caused this fire. So it's very difficult to comment on it.
Okay, if you like what the UK Column does, you would like to support us, please go to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out there are there, and your support is needed because it is only your support that keeps us going. You can pick something up at the UK Column shop, and thank you very much to everybody that has done so. But please do share anything on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. We're only a week and a day until we start the Climate Science Masterclass with David Siegel. I'm going to say thank you very much to everybody that has bought a ticket so far. The early bird tickets are all gone, and I'm really looking forward to that. On Tuesday the 19th is when we're starting. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., I will be speaking to Matt Errett, and a really interesting conversation on the hidden hand behind UFOs. This starts with H.G. Wells, with Aldous and Julian Huxley, with Bertrand Russell. It's quite an interesting conversation, and I encourage everybody to join us at 1 p.m. for that.
And I'll just add that the reporting of UFOs has been standard military procedure for a great many years, particularly for the aviators.
Where does that take us?
Well, we've got some adverts. We've got Glasgow Freedom Rally, which is George Square, Glasgow, 1 p.m. on Saturday, the 13th of April. So watch out for that one. What does the WHO have in store for you? Well, I think we know, and it's not very nice. We've also got this one here, National Emergency. The New Forest in the south of England is being what they call clear felled to build a free point, a free port. So we've got people warning about that, and you'll be able to find out more about it if you can attend the Lyndhurst Community Centre, which is in the middle of the New Forest area, and that's Thursday, March the 21st. If you have a look for the details of that, I'll just give you the postcode. It's SO437NY. And that's the 21st of March. And then we've also got the People's Health Alliance for a Glastonbury event. We've got Dr. Alex Ling, Dr. Joe Whitaker, and EE Systems, which is talking about the power that made the body heals the body. That's Friday the 15th of March, 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. And it's the Town Hall, Magdalene Street, Glastonbury. And this one here, controlled society or free society. This is Thursday, the 11th of April, 4:45 to 9:30 p.m. at the Emmanuel Centre, Marsham Street, London. And who's going to be there? Well, Andrew Bridgen MP, who's doing such a great job, but also Sandy Adams. Great to see Sandy there alongside him. Scott McCullough, lead outside council, CHD, and Jim Ferguson, a farming expert. Plus, they've got other guest speakers. So it's really great to see people coming together. And I'll just put this one up on screen because we know that Andrew Bridgen's doing a lot of work to help publicise himself at the moment. And we know that anybody who can help in the constituency area could be of great value to him because, of course, he's now up against the machinery of the big mainstream parties.
Mark, freedom of speech, what's the Bryanstone Institute been telling us about?
Well, this is an interesting item, and I'll mention at the tail end of your ads, speaking of freedom of speech and information, I have a relatively new article at the UK Column website about the so-called new media portraying itself as new and fresh and different, and really it's the same old song and dance, a repackaged mass media cartel, a repackaged legacy media. That's a series I'm writing for UK Column. The first installment is up on the website now. But the Brownstone Institute is talking about a particular case, a lawsuit in the United States, where free speech seems to truly hang in the balance and Supreme Court action is expected soon. This is a relatively breezy report. Let's go on to the next slide here. This is the Brownstone's own observations in this very important article. In a lifetime of observing policy controversies and court cases, we've never witnessed anything as crucial to the future of the idea of freedom itself compared with what will transpire coming up on the 18th of March, 2024. On that day, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in the suit Murphy versus Missouri. Missouri is the injured party here, concerning whether the government can force or nudge private companies to censor users on behalf of regime priorities. And one of the big concerns here or observations is that these private companies, the main social media companies and the government are becoming as one. So the fact that the companies are private, but if they're being commandeered by the government, there eventually becomes very little difference between the two. The distinctions tend to melt away. Anyway, the evidence that they have been doing so is overwhelming, the Brownstone continues in their article. That's why the Fifth Circuit in the United States issued an emergency injunction to stop the practice of this censorship on the grounds that it's inconsistent with the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The censorship industrial complex, it's being called, the censorship industrial complex, I've never heard that term, is working right now around the clock to delete free speech in America. That injunction, however, was stayed pending a review by the highest court or the Supreme Court. Moving on from there, the justices hearing the case will be in an awkward position, Brownstone is saying. My guess is that none of them even know that this was going on to the extent that it is. They will likely be shocked when they look at the evidence proving there is a $1 trillion industry, we're being told here, in full operation that has massively distorted the public mind. Sometimes they call it curating the public mind. That terminology is used as well. Every federal agency, get that, every federal agency is involved, deeply embedded in the operations of all media companies, that would be legacy, not places like UK Column, obviously, and digital technology, which in turn requires universal surveillance and persecution of contrary voices. And a little while ago in my first report, we heard about the Military Times worried that veterans are catching on to many of the lies that they are being exposed to. And remember, veterans go out, many of them, believing they're fighting to defend free speech, and now their minds are being curated. Anyway, this last item here, until a few years ago, this entire industry, this $1 trillion industry, which involves federal agencies, universities, nonprofits, shadow companies, bogus fact checkers, and every manner of spook-operated front companies, get that, until a few years ago, this was not known to exist Brownstone is saying. But now that we know about it, we're shocked by the extent of it. It has invaded the whole of our lives to the point that we cannot tell real news from that which is fed to us by intelligence agencies. This is another reason I'm doing this series in UK Column about the legacy media's fake repackaging. Even worse, Brownstone says, we've come to expect that most of what passes for approved opinion is flat out false. And the implication, guys, is that news outlets like ours are also potentially on the chopping block if this trillion-dollar industry is allowed to have its way. So this is a very tectonic item, and it's important to keep an eye on it long term. So I'll be reporting more on this in my series on the UK Column website and on my weekly report. So back to you.
Mark, thank you very much for that. Well, a nice lead into this little segment here, which is the BBC manipulating information. My attention was drawn to the Oscar ceremonies. This is the BBC report. Zone of Interest director Jonathan Glazer makes Gaza statement in Oscar's speech. And the quote on the right of your screen is what the BBC actually opened with. It says, director Jonathan Glazer focused on the war in Gaza in his acceptance speech at the Oscars, saying that he refuted his Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation. But we need to say something here, because he didn't actually say that. He said a little bit more, which makes a huge difference to the meaning. So let's listen to what he did say, because the BBC couldn't be bothered to insert a film video clip to actually show him speaking. They just used a graphic. So let's put the video clip in.
And the oath, and the Oscar goes to the Son of Interest. This is the third nomination for the United Kingdom. The Zone of Interest is the ninth non-English language film to be nominated for both International Feature Film and Best Picture in the same year.
Thank you so much. I'm going to read, I'm afraid. Thank you to the Academy for this honour, and to our partners A24 Film for Access and the Polish Film Institute, to the Auschwitz-Birkenau State Museum for their trust and guidance, to my producers, actors, collaborators. All our choices were made to reflect and confront us in the present, not to say look what they did then, rather look what we do now. Our film shows where dehumanisation leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October the... Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladziejczyk, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
So the BBC, of course, didn't say what he exactly said, because what he said was very important. But what the BBC did show in a video at the end of the article, so that it was rammed into people's minds, was this clip.
Area, you're holding people up that direction. Go east.
So the BBC clearly at its worst, because the man was brave enough to say refuted being Jewish as a result of what was happening to innocent people, both in Israel and in Gaza. He's cut out. And then we have the propaganda video at the bottom. But what are we really seeing? A pretty brutal looking police protecting the rich and famous against people who are unhappy that people are being slaughtered in large numbers. I just put up this meme, which was sent to me over the weekend, and I think it really says it all. So obviously it's Gaza with a rain of bombs, but in between the bombs are one or two loaves of bread tossed to the needy.
Now, in Belfast, we'll just bring this tweet on screen. So this is from Carlos Latouf, who is a cartoonist. He said, I received with some surprise the news that one of my cartoons converted to a mural in Belfast was defaced. The cartoon in question criticises the decision of the Irish Republican parties, Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, to celebrate St. Patrick's Day with Joe Biden. And, well, you can see that the cartoon is painted on the wall there, and then somebody has come along and painted over it in black. We'll just put the image that he, the original cartoon, on screen. Of course, somebody was asking me recently about Sinn Féin in particular. They are now just an internationalist party like any other, like the Scottish Nationalist Party, for example. They'd be quite happy to kneel down in front of Joe Biden in this way. I think that's quite an appropriate image. Now, at the weekend then, video footage appeared on social media of a guy being arrested by the police because he was apparently holding a sign saying Hamas are terrorists. Let's have a look at the footage.
Leave it!
Hey!
Hey! What do you do? Oh my God! You're supporting Hamas!
Guys, you had an anti-Hamas sign.
Just move back a wee bit forward, please. Just stay by. Just give him space to work, please.
Shame on you! He attacked me! And you asked me! Shame on you! Give me my iPod! Shame on you for supporting Hamas! Leave me alone! You attacked me! No!
Alright, sir, can we help?
Probably not, no.
Okay, can I help at all while you didn't want to film?
Yeah, I'm documenting what you're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
No, it's not a problem. I'm just conscious why you wouldn't film a gentleman being arrested.
Because he's got an anti-Hamas flag and he's been arrested. And yet, what I've seen here, hadn't been arrested.
Right, okay, John.
So the police then felt the need, because everybody was asking on social media why this guy had been arrested, when people in the main demonstration, which of course was pro-Palestine demonstration, weren't being arrested. So the police felt the need to put out a statement. This is what they said. A video has been posted on X alleging officers arrested a man for having an anti-Hamas placard. This isn't accurate. He was arrested after an altercation was ongoing and officers intervened to prevent a breach of the peace. He was arrested for assault. Officers then fully reviewed footage provided of the incident. He was later de-arrested. The arrest was not made in relation to the placard. That's their claim. But of course, by the time that went out, the story had gone all across social media. And I just want to ask the question, Brian, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but if the powers that be, let's say, wanted to create tension within a society, is this not exactly how they would do it? Because the injustice in this seems to be, the perception of injustice at least seems to be there.
Yeah, well, it's exactly what they would do. But of course, the police doing themselves no favours at all, because every time it seems we see the British police in action, they become ever more brutal. But divide and rule, that's the way to deal with the British public, and we see a lot more of it. Well, let's go and have a look at society in Ukraine. And this little article was sent to me over the weekend. Now, I'm going to say straight away that I haven't been able to fully verify it, but I'm going to take it on face value. What it was warning about was plans for millions, I think the figure was 3 million Ukrainian women to be mobilized. Now, I'm just taking it on face value, but let's have a look at what's previously been said about the use of women in the war. So this is the New York Times from some little time ago. It says, if not me, who? As Ukraine seeks troops, women prepare for the call. And of course, there, it's now well known that Ukrainian women have been in the front lines and they're dying on the front lines because, of course, overall, they're unsuitable, inexperienced troops. But this is what is happening in Ukrainian society in order to fight the West proxy war. And I went looking on the Kiev Post to see if there was anything about the mobilization. There wasn't. But I found this article, which I also found extraordinary. So we've got two women looking very tired and sad against the backdrop of men who've been killed on the battlefield. Remember, the figure that we're talking about is around 400,000. And what's the headline? Opinion, Rebuilding Ukraine, the Task for Women. And the obscenity of this article is that it is crowing that the war is a wonderful opportunity to bring more women fully into the workforce in Ukraine. And this is going to liberate women. So get the women into heavy industry, get them down the coal mines, make best use of the war, because this will turn Ukrainian society from being a backward society into a fully fledged Western society. So I'm not the only person who's beginning to see this outrageous twisting of truth. This is a meme that was circulating. Some people might find this offensive, but it's the sentiment. So it's come from apolitical, peak liberalism, sending your daughters to fight and die in war so that your son can be a cross-dressing homosexual. So many people now starting to actually pick up and say, what actually is the agenda that the West is pushing? But at the end of the day, one thing's for certain, and that's many more women are going to be dying on the battlefield in Ukraine.
Mark, bring us up to date on the IHR and the treaty.
Yes, thanks, guys. Last night, I got a call from James Roguski. Of course, his Substack, his website is jamesroguski.substack.com. Roguski is R-O-G-U-S-K-I. And he gave me an up-to-the-minute report. I kind of put it in today's show at the last minute. It's very important. One thing I'll mention is by next week, the following week at the very latest, we're going to have more contact information, more ways that our readers and viewers can get involved and contact places such as the Office of Global Affairs of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which is the negotiating body for the U.S. part of the treaty. But this is some of what James has got at his website that I mentioned. And also, if you go there, there's some very helpful videos. There's rejecttheamendments.com, another link. Lots of things people can read and learn and get involved with. So that's the main thing, to get involved. And I'll just kind of hit some of the highlights. So let's go back to the previous one there. This is about the treaty. The top 10 reasons, I'll just hit the highlights. The Framework Convention and Unaccountable Bureaucracy, Articles 21 through 37, billions of dollars, mass expansion of public health emergency of international concern, PHEIC, One Health Surveillance. I talked about One Health last week, pathogen access benefit sharing system, global supply chain and logistics network, failure to hold Big Pharma liable for harm, and censorship, a big topic these days. That's just some of the reasons to stop the treaty. And now we have also the international health regulations, which I haven't focused on as much lately, but they're just as important. They're on a parallel track. This is again from Rogowski, three levels of fear mongering. And you can read about it in the show notes, quarantine concerns, documents required for travel. Things are getting pretty oppressive. Vaccines authorized by the WHO for emergency use. Requiring vaccines, especially those that are authorized for emergency use, is unacceptable, James is saying. Making non-state actors comply with public health measures. And James gives a lot of the articles where you can read more about this in the articles that he published. There's the other half here, surveillance concerns, national IHR authority, disclosure of personal data concerns, and again, censorship and disinformation being attached to anyone that tries to discuss these things openly and honestly. Next week, again, I'll have more, especially I expect to have more on how people can become more directly involved. But for now, you can go to past reports I've done on UK Column, as well as James Rogowski's research. So I wanted to get that in for today, guys.
Thank you, Mark. Switzerland, Belgium, and the Netherlands, of course, are the three countries in Europe that have already brought in assisted dying legislation. The UK possibly not too far behind, being led by Esther Ranson. And of course, she had her petition. That petition ended up having 152,761 signatures on it. And we wait to see whether the UK government is going to hold a debate. They say that they've already held debates in recent years, and this is something for the House of Commons and not for government. But if we just put that back on screen for a second, Ranson's daughter now getting involved in the conversation to push for assisted dying legislation in the UK. Well, we don't have to worry, because in France, Emmanuel Macron has decided to bring legislation forward as well. So he has announced this now. So let's just have a look at what he had to say. He said it does not strictly, this is legislation he's talking about, does not strictly speaking create a new right or a freedom, but it traces a path which did not exist until now and which opens the possibility of requesting assistance in dying under strict conditions. He's saying that the conditions would need to be met that are in the legislation, that a medical team would need to assess and ensure the criteria that the decision was correct. But we don't need to worry, because families would be allowed to appeal any decision that was made. But they're trying to say very clearly that the person would have to be competent. How they make that decision, I suppose, is open. But lots of these things are open to interpretation, yeah. Brian, and I'm not sure exactly where that ends. But what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a horrible agenda. It's clearly anti-life. And the other thing is that this cannot be a national agenda, because it's coming out through so many countries. So this has got to be a globalist agenda. And yeah, let's emphasize it. What are they talking about? Making it easier for people to die. And so we've got a death cult. I'm going to call it a death cult, which is trying to install itself, a death cult that is happy with the wars. It's happy with killing off elderly people. And at the end of the day, what is it doing? Divide and rule to control us. For anybody to say there's no such thing as global policy emerging, clearly, you know, has got no mental acumen at all, because they simply cannot see the evidence which is on the table in front of them.
Well, Mark, very quickly, is this something which is in the media agenda in the United States?
I wouldn't call it right up front. This has been floating around ever since Dr. Kevorkian and some of those controversies quite some time ago. What I would only briefly comment about, guys, is notice what he says. It does not strictly speaking create a new right nor a freedom. This guy thinks that government edicts and statutes and whatnot create rights. Rights are a natural born, innate, God-given thing that pre-exists governments and exists separately from governments. So this guy is of the mind that, globalist apparatchiks like him create rights. And that's a civic disaster. That whole idea is a philosophical black hole. And so this tells a lot about him.
Absolutely, Mark. Couldn't agree more. But of course, that's the foundation of human rights and the whole principle of human rights. We have a little bit of video to end on.
Well, we do, and I should be interested for a bit of comment from Mark, but let's just roll it and see what happened.
You're a dictator, do genocide, Joe! Tens of thousands of Palestinians!
So there we are. I can't remember where the Biden rally was, Missouri or Mississippi. You will hopefully be able to tell me, Mark, but obviously a very angry man interjects with the whole trouble of the war. But what really shocked me was to see people calling for four more years of a man who, to me, needs to be retired now before his very tired and befuddled brain does any more damage to the United States or the world. What's your take?
Well, maybe Mr. Biden is getting old like a fox. Maybe he's not quite as much of a dullard as we think. But honestly, I don't think his mind and or physical stature has four more years left in it. But it's interesting to see that kind of protest right in his face. It reminds me of Justin Trudeau of Canada traveling to the western, more conservative parts of Canada and being called a piece of shite, excuse my language there, but and worse, and smiling as if nothing's happening. Politicians like Trudeau and Biden, in many cases, have the public's deepest wishes that they get out and are extremely seen as anachronisms and seen as tyrants by the people. And they just don't acknowledge how much the people are disgusted with their performance. So Biden is evidently, you know, kind of oblivious to just how much opposition there is out there to what's going on in Gaza, as we heard there. So much could be said, but there's not much time to say more than that. So,
okay, Mark, thank you very much for that. We'll leave it there. Sad times of the world.
I think Biden's probably oblivious to most of what goes on around it anyway.
Yeah. Indeed. So thank you very much, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining UK Column News today. And a huge thank you to all our members. We can only do what we do with your financial support. And we really do value your ongoing support. We need to end the news there. There will be a UK Column Extra in a few minutes for UK Column members. Aside from that, we'll be back at the same time on Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
Bye-bye.
Then bye-bye.